Hello, everybody. This is Susan Piver, and it is my honor to welcome you to this Buddhist call about Buddhism and relationships with Nick Kranz. I'm very honored and appreciative that the Open Heart Project can present you with this call, and mostly to present you with the opportunity to connect with Nick, who is a wonderful teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist lineage, a senior teacher. And I say this because I have been in classes with him, and I've heard him teach, and I've seen him teach. And in addition to being a true student of the Dharma, who has a vast, I would say, storehouse of knowledge contained in his mind about the true Dharma, meaning he's studied a lot, and he has retained what he studied, and he has brought it into his experience to the extent that he can share it with us in very straightforward language. In addition to all of that, I would say, and Nick, you can close your ears because I don't want to embarrass you or anything, that he has a gift for love. He has a gift for connecting with his fellow humans and a gift for feeling the presence of others in his heart and for offering his knowledge and caring straight from his own heart. So that is a rare thing. I am very happy to welcome him. And also, if you want to learn more about him after this call, you can find him at his website, nickkranz.com, K-R-A-N-Z. And if you want to stay in touch with him, he has a newsletter you can sign up for. And he also teaches at the Daily Dharma Gathering a lot in the Open Heart Project. So anyway, it is my honor to welcome you, Nick, and I request that you teach us.
Thank you, Susan. It's such an honor to be here and to be with everyone, taking this time to come together and put our heads and hearts together around what is truly a vast and profound exploration. You know, and I was talking to Susan about this before we're offering something. You know, she was mentioning this quality of love being, it's like it having this mysterious quality that it has its own course, and it either deepens or it changes or ends. And, you know, that really is such a powerful way of thinking of our relationships. And you know, the opportunity there for us, there are many ways that that river could flow. And if you think of a river with many tributaries, I think love is like that, and I think relationships are like that. And so, you know, there's no one way, so to speak. But I think I have been really curious as a Buddhist and as a practitioner, and with all of my friends and companions on the journey, to explore what is it that we want in relationships, meaningful connections. And I think it is a very fundamental human thing to want connection and to want to explore ourselves and another person. In my own personal relationships, both with my previous partners and my wife now, there's been a continuing theme that I've shared with these remarkable people, which is this aspiration to keep growing together. And so that's sort of, I think, the starting point of a relationship, as opposed to just a casual friendship or encounter or an acquaintance. When we spend more time with somebody and begin to have this feeling of something, you know, a certain something that's, you know, the French je ne sais quoi, you know, it's hard to describe, but growing together is some kind of seed there that seems important. And there aren't any guarantees what will happen. But we can ask ourselves, if we want to deepen in relationship, then if the answer is yes, then there's sort of I think what I've gleaned from, again, myself and others and from studying many Dharma teachers is that we are required to come as we are, to be welcomed as we are. And here I don't mean required like there's any sort of law or rule and there's only, you know, that way that can work, but I think as a general baseline, if we're not comfortable being who we are, being in relationship will not be comfortable either. If we're not welcomed by someone as we are to some degree, to varying degrees, but to some degree, then it will probably be very hard for us to feel satisfied and cared for. So I think this is the sort of, you know, the depot station of friendships and relationships. This is the starting point where all roads lead to Rome. And it's a teaching that I think we know more commonly as Maitri in Sanskrit or Metta in Pali and loving kindness in English. And over this period of time we have together during this hour, I will go through a number of teachings, about 8 different teachings, that all kind of point us towards Rome or, you know, towards going deeper and growing with another person. And beginning here, the first stop, you could say, on our journey, being this gentleness and this friendliness. Traditionally, loving kindness is generating a heart or mind that is tender and strong. And you could say that it has different factors to it. It's something that we might develop in our basic sitting meditation. And we might specifically develop it in Maitri or Metta practice. But these qualities also come out on the spot in our life and in our relationships. You could say that the first quality that comes to mind is this tenderness or being in touch with what we feel. We are learning how to be with our emotions, feel our heart, feel our fear, and we are opening to our fearfulness and our restlessness, and we're learning how to abide with emotions as a person who is steadfast, you could say, or stable with body and mind. When we can remain in our body, in the present moment, synchronized with what we're feeling, it takes a lot of courage, and it takes our attention and our care. We're making a choice each moment to be fully here. And I think this is, on some level, it's so obvious that it's sort of belies a description. It's like, well, of course you have to be friendly to start a relationship or a friendship. But it's amazing how many friendships and how many connections might not consciously have that commitment at their core, or we don't actually know how to be friendly with ourselves. So there are times where it comes out with a partner or vice versa, where it's not our intention, but we end up acting out some of our frustration. And of course, that tends to winnow away at the feeling of trust, feeling of respect, feeling of safety. So there's something here For sure. There's something very alive in being with ourselves. And I thought maybe we could just distill one aspect of this loving kindness or gentleness as a foundation. And this would be the aspect of giving up expectations. How do we do that? Why would we do that? Part of that is that when we are tender or in touch with what we're feeling, it really doesn't matter what it is that we might be feeling or what it is that's going on. It's how we're working with it. And that's where friendliness really comes alive and gentleness. Friendliness is animated when the going gets rough. And that's when we are challenged. That's when our character emerges in some sense. And so we can train in this gentleness and loving kindness, both in the formal practice of Maitri, but also by just contemplating for a moment how we might give up expectations so that we might just feel what another person is going through and really just listen for a moment. Maybe not giving them up altogether, but just suspending them for a bit. Let's contemplate what that feels like. I feel like when I give up expectations, I feel a little bit of fear. I'm afraid that I might be losing control, or that my friend or lover or partner might feel unruly. You know, I can't handle this intense feeling that they're having, or they're experiencing or doing things that I don't want. But if I give up my expectation, there's a moment of tenderness where I'm in touch with my own feelings. And it's from that heart, from that place, that if we speak from that place of tenderness, usually it's likely that people can trust us more. Not always, but there's some possibility there. A working basis can happen from that gentleness. The second stop on our journey, you could say, I would refer to as the mirror principle. This is talking about having the opportunity to be mirrored by another person and to be mirrored to ourselves. And here you could say this is a kind of fundamental honesty that comes about through the process of doing a lot of practicing of meditation and choosing to come back to our present experience in our daily life, day after day, year after year. You could say that that process is really about having less and less self-deception. And that kind of honesty or clarity is something that you could say a mirror has. It's said to be just reflecting without opinion. So let's look through a few of the different ways we can feel frustrated or challenged by having a close relationship. And let's look at these various feelings or emotions in the light of having someone mirror back to us our own experience of that and how it's affecting them. So let's look at, for a moment, fear or hope as a mirror. Think about something that in a relationship or romantic or a friendship of long term that we are afraid of happening, or that we hope doesn't happen, or hope does this happens, but some kind of quality like that. What is something we are hoping or fearing in our relationship? And now we can envision having to explain or interact with another human being who has their own set of needs and wants. And how we choose to express what we're feeling to them, it is also a kind of mirror principle in that it mirrors the way that we generally respond to our world. You could say that between two people, there is a sort of core of society. Perhaps we feel we're not up to the task in a relationship, or our ineptitude to be the ideal person or partner for ourselves or someone else. Another way of looking at this is, what are the demands that we place on ourselves or others place on us? Just bringing some of these scenarios to mind. Being mirrored, being seen by someone. Why is this helpful? You know, these things can be very challenging. If we just had our own little space and no one interacted with us, we might create very cozy environs that don't challenge us, or in which we don't often get to see how we're affecting other people with our particular approach. This quality of looking at our qualities or our challenges with this mirror-like quality of relating to another person's well-being as well as our own. We could look at our confusion, our feeling of uncertainty. When someone else sees us struggling, if we open up and allow them in, sometimes it's embarrassing. It's like, you know, it's like being video recorded or something, and no, turn that thing off. You know, I don't want anyone to see me in this way. And yet with our intimate partners and close companions, there's really no way that we can hide from them completely. And there's some quality of growing together with this sort of basic wish that these things become opportunities to see parts of ourselves that normally we might be in our blind spot. They might be in our shadow. They might be hard for us to acknowledge. Falling in love, sort of the ability to just really appreciate somebody. You meet somebody and just think they're remarkable. You could say you fall in love on the spot. We have this incredible ability as human beings to love. And if we just get absorbed in the act or feeling of it, we don't have this mirror quality. We don't tend to see and learn as clearly from the things that we're doing. Maybe our journey is endless, but it does seem like when we learn certain things about ourselves in the light of someone else's help and awareness, that it can transform our experience. We sort of have learned that lesson. Maybe it comes back again and again, but now we have a different way of relating to it. We see it in the light of day. That's the quality of mirror. A third teaching in our journey is looking at our motivation You know, each of us is uniquely motivated. There's not one way to approach anything as evidenced by our world. It's pretty clear. And it's said that motivation, in terms of our meditation practice, it actually determines the quality of our practice. It turns out that meditation practice itself is quite neutral, but that our motivation or reason for engaging in it is what gives it its fuel and power. There is a Buddhist saying that goes, with love, all levels and paths are good. And in this sense, it means that when we have this connection with a deeper motivation based on a deep principle of empathy, of wanting to help others to realize their brilliance, it's said that we can handle a lot more. We feel a greater sense of workability. In my experience, motivation is sometimes hidden to us. So it requires both of the preceding qualities mentioned to access it. We need to have tenderness, friendliness, gentleness, a quality of giving up our expectations on ourselves for a moment and just acknowledging ourselves as we are, accepting ourselves for how we are arising in this moment. And then that quality of mirror, some quality of introspection or reflection or being mirrored by another person. We sort of learn about our motivation when those two are together. If there is a basic quality of aggression, then unfortunately, we're at war. I mean, it's so simple, but I don't think it feels that clear when we're in the midst of really wanting things to be different than they are. Like many of you, I have felt enormous pain and frustration in the last weeks in the way that we are seeing racial tension play out and this overwhelming systemic injustice that's been happening for hundreds and hundreds of years. And there's a feeling of helplessness. And I think when we're in that feeling, sometimes we just want to see change. In fact, some people have been motivated out of so much frustration. They've been motivated to violence to try to achieve change. So in that macrocosmic scale, we see how destructive aggression can be. But again, when we're experiencing it, we never feel like we're the bad guy, the bad gal, the bad human being. And from a fundamental point of view, there aren't any bad human beings. There are confused human beings. And so from this fundamental view, motivation is about digging into the underlying energy and inspiration for some of our actions. And when we have this quality of gentleness towards what we're feeling, that doesn't mean we're not feeling terrible. That doesn't mean we're not feeling overwhelmed. As Pema Chodron has said, it's not what's arising, it's how we're working with it. So we return to this notion of introspection and gentleness achieve a closer connection with our motivation. The motivation we have changes moment by moment, day by day. Checking in with it is the quality of being feeling and being workable. And this notion that with love, all levels and paths are good is another way of saying that if we start with this foundation and if we rouse and fan this ember in our heart of being gentle to what we're feeling, accommodating our pain and not giving up, this doesn't mean that we just sort of say, well, there's nothing I can do. We may decide to do all sorts of things. In fact, we're always doing all sorts of things. That's what motivation is really saying. As Sakyong Nyipama said, we're always meditating. The question is upon what? And so apathy is also a very strong contribution. We don't escape the karmic interaction of being in interdependence, even if we don't acknowledge it. So motivation is this pithy way of getting into who we are and how we tick. What makes us arise in the way that we do. This brings us to our fourth stop on the journey. And I don't know if there's an easy way to say this, so I just put it as diversity of perceptual styles. The Buddha families are teaching in Buddhism, which talk about five fundamental styles that are connected to five fundamental emotions, elements, etc. And this is a wonderful teaching because it gives us some sort of context for the different ways that people see the world and arise from their vantage point or their intersectionality with others. Another fantastic system, of which Susan Piver is an amazing expert, is the Enneagram. And this is a very detailed system of exploring all the various kind of vantage points and ongoing sort of styles that people have. So there are wonderful teachings, many wisdom traditions, that help us get to a bigger view so that we don't project onto other people that they ought to approach things like us, but we start to develop a cosmopolitan or, vaster view of, hey, there's more than one way to do this, different strokes. But very briefly, I thought I'd just touch into some of the most basic patterns that we might recognize, the driving styles on our journey of relationships. And one of these, and this is, with no judgment, right? We may be this person. We may be mad at one of these people. We may be what, it doesn't matter, but it's just part of the journey. And we're bringing that sort of gentleness and mirror-like quality to our motivation and really looking. So the first style, I don't know how else to put it. Maybe they're the serial rebounder. they're a heartbreaker to some, or they break their own heart. They are the kind of person who approaches relationships not unlike Goldilocks. That it's too hot, too cold, has to be just right. And there's something very exhilarating about a person who's looking for this thrill of connecting. But once things hit a certain level or plateau, they're out of there. And, on some level you could say this is probably because this type of person is afraid of intimacy. They're afraid of the challenges, or perhaps they just don't trust that people can grow together. So that's one way that we might see people erring towards, and there are all sorts of variations. Another common thing we've seen perhaps in dysfunctional relationships is what you might call the business deal of ego. It's the handshake. The two people tolerate each other, they perpetuate each other, their habitual patterns, and they also ignore each other. And, it's a very sad thing to see a kind of relationship where people are not growing together. These are two variations of relationships not growing together. They're sort of maybe two basic ones, but there's probably many. But I think the questions that we can ask ourselves is, do I want to see so clearly? Am I on a path with anyone? If I'm not feeling a sense of growing with someone, then there's no point in bothering. I mean, we look at divorce rates at this time, and we have a very consumer culture. And, there's this kind of trade-in thing. Well, that model's outdated. I want a new one. And I think that comes from having very shallow roots for getting, say, married in the first place. But I think it's all fun and games until someone gets hurt. And I think the idea here is that we're trying to build relationships that express our good human heart and that help us help other people to understand themselves and grow and deepen their own appreciation of being alive. And I think that that's not an easy thing to do. It definitely has a path-like quality. But I think that when we have this sense of, if my style is to fall in love all the time, or if my style is to stay busy at work, or if my style is to sort of intellectualize things and explain why I'm right, or if my style is to ignore everything, or et cetera, whatever kind of style we have, let's go back to step number one. It has to come back to gentleness and loving kindness. Whoever we are and whatever the raw materials of our partner, those have to be couched in terms of gentleness and accommodating and some sense of growing together. When we look at motivation, we're iterating over time. We're realizing that there's a mirror-like quality to being in relationships. And there's a quality of learning from them, learning about who we are and why we do what we do. We don't always know. Sometimes it surprises us, doesn't it? And then there's an opportunity once again for this gentleness and friendliness. We are not being gentle and friendly in order to enable the parts of ourselves or another person that are dysfunctional or dishonest. We're not sort of having to consent to habitual patterns to be accepting. Here, by accepting and gentle, we're referring to the experience of tenderness and that accommodation, that we can feel what's really going on without aggression, and then there's a mirror-like quality that we can learn from. And then we can look at our motivation and maybe be inspired, maybe feel a different pathway forward, all the while appreciating our particular approach to reality and not seeing it as a condemnation. So the fifth teaching on our journey is about this notion of the middle way. And here, the middle way is a traditional Buddhist teaching. And it's said that in the story of Siddhartha Gautama, the historical Buddha, in his life, he was practicing in a way in which he wanted to vanquish death. That's a very noble, audacious aspiration and very, very inspiring. And he was studying with the greatest teachers of his age, and they were very into, many of them, the ascetic tradition. And he was at a point on his journey where he'd mastered their meditations, and he could subsist on a grain of rice a day. You may have seen a statue of the Buddha, emaciated and bones protruding, almost ghoulish looking. And at this time, it's said that Sujata, a woman moving toward the well, saw the Buddha, and she gasped in horror at looking at his condition. She returned with a bowl of milk and offered this. And in that moment, the Buddha had been rejecting food, and he realized that there was a middle way. Because of the kindness of Sujata, because of how she was mirroring him, he had an insight that he'd gone too far to one side. That it's not about attachment and it's not about repression. It's the middle way between these two. And so at that moment, it said that he drank the milk and felt the compassion that Sujata was offering. And it's interesting because that actually is a full circle, right? Giving and receiving completes the compassionate act. So this is another way of saying, what is the middle way? Well, it's finding the way between habitual patterns and, you know, getting entrenched with somebody and just sort of tuning out and leaving somebody. It's not that once hearing the middle way answers the $64 million question of when is a relationship over or when should you keep going. I mean, that's just so personal, right? That's the part that's just your river. It's your particular journey. But what the middle way is saying is that we could embrace the whole person. We could relate to another human being and develop a shared culture with them. You could look at this as compromise, but often we look at compromise and think, well, then both people are really upset. That's just compromise gone wrong. So I think the way to look at this, at the middle way in relationships, or one way, is that often we're using stepping stones as obstacles. In other words, we're thinking we can improve or make ourselves or our partner better again and again. And by doing that, we drive a wedge between ourselves and our partner. So if we can flip that around and turn obstacles into stepping stones, then we have an opportunity to work with our attachment, to work with our, aversion, to work with each other in a way where we keep deepening and keep growing together. Without a shared culture, I don't know how people grow together. It's a mystery. It's quite magical and uncertain. But if you have the support of some kind of intentional shared culture, there can be a healthy connection based on, you know, becoming, as Trungpa Rinpoche used to say, a truly cosmic adult. And this is another way of saying opening up to the vastness of our world and maturing and finding that what we want and what another person wants are workable and exciting and alive. So the next stop on our journey has to do with compassion. You know, is compassion love? Is love attachment? You know, there's this funny kind of feeling of, well, if compassion's unconditional, you know, love can't necessarily be unconditional in a relationship. You know, you have to have some kind of boundaries, right? And that's part of the shared culture. We might drop our expectations, but then we also aren't afraid to share our boundaries and our quality of reemerging with healthy expectations that are based on actually having felt and seen the other person with gentleness. Then we can return to them, and we don't have to denigrate what our needs are, and we don't have to denigrate theirs. We can try to chart a course together. So compassion is really more about the expression of that in an ongoing way. Expressing compassion in a relationship is not about attachment. It's about touching in with our own sore spot, our own sense of tenderness. And this is something that takes courage to do. There's a wonderful phrase from Zoketsu Norman Fisher Roshi, who is a Zen teacher in Suzuki Roshi's lineage. And he said that love is a way of life. So let's take a moment and just contemplate how we feel compassion and our love in relationships intersect. How are they similar? How are they different? When we feel compassion for our partner, are we in touch with our body? Kind of tenderness or softness, a heaviness. What do we feel in our body? we have allowed another person to affect us. We've cared about them. And there's a meeting point. There's a communication between our own vulnerability and another person's. That vulnerability is compassion. Khunpa Rinpoche talked about this, that he said that when our sore spot and the sort of external sensitivity we have to others and our internal basic goodness or Buddha nature, when those two meet, we begin to realize that our whole being is made out of one complete sore spot altogether. It goes on to say, both are sensitive to cold air, hot air, and little disturbances of atmosphere, which begin to affect us both, inwardly and outwardly. It is the living flame of love, if you would like to call it that. It's so beautiful. The living flame of love, being able to care for someone, even when we do have expectations, when we do have boundaries, but we also care about their journey. Isn't that an interesting balance? We're not just in it for ourselves. The expression of developing a culture with another person is like maturing that third thing that happens when two people come together. That third thing is unique to the two people's chemistry, and it's an energetic field or sphere. In the beginning, relationships have maybe a lot of sort of energy and verve. You know, there's a lot of life in playfulness, you could say. And then over time, naturally, we run into these plateaus of different styles, familiarity with each other, some frustration, and a quality of maturity of truly wanting to grow together is tested at another level. And at this level, we realize that it's very easy to fall into a kind of insensitivity to our partner. This goes back to the styles I mentioned, that either we tune out and leave, or if we remain, we're kind of in a habitual handshake, an agreement to not stimulate each other's sore spots too much. But when we do feel our sore spot, both inside and outside, that we're touched by our partner, to say that vulnerability is compassion is because we can't choose to care. And that's a really important part of love. We really have no way to defend ourselves at this level. But the good news is we're not powerless. We're not fighting with this feeling. It is subsuming us. It is meaning. It is beyond our personal comfort alone. And it's more satisfying than our personal comfort. We feel truly connected and a part of the bigger world, of which we are, of course, a part of. And this is expressed with compassion. So let's just take a moment and contemplate for ourselves what compassion feels like again. And just touch in with, what does it feel to have compassion for ourselves? And we'll start there. What does it feel like to have compassion for ourselves? The wish that we're free from suffering. How does that feel in our body and mind? And now we could just shift that feeling or that exploration to someone whom we're in a relationship with or friendship with or an acquaintance. What does it feel like when we rouse a mind of compassion or feel genuine empathy for their unique and specific condition? How does that feel in our body and mind? And just knowing that as we familiarize ourselves with our emotions and feelings, we become emotional ninjas eventually, gradually, over years. But we learn how to practice and feel nimble, and we're so familiar with the terrain, we know where and how to relate to it and when. There's a quality of familiarity in the meditative world does not breed contempt. Familiarity breeds mastery. So, moving on to our next stop, we can explore the notion of impermanence. This is a classical teaching in Buddhism. And it really is a vast topic, but in the terms of relationships, I love it. It's sort of the great leveler. If you're having a particular drama or challenge with someone you care about, when you bring to mind the teaching on impermanence, suddenly everything changes. At least it can. And sometimes we're so frustrated, we don't let ourselves really touch in with the reality of impermanence. We kind of keep it at a distance, and that's okay too. I think whatever we feel is okay, because gentleness, again, is the foundation, and without it, everything else seems to fall apart. But this notion of impermanence, I thought we could try just a little exercise. And in this case, it's working with our own precious life and the fact that it isn't permanent here, that being in this body, whatever this body is not permanent. The mind itself, it is something that is ungraspable. Tibetans would say, everyone dies, but no one is dead. And they would point to the fact that when you look at a corpse, all the organs are perfectly intact, but the animating force is gone. So, very interesting notion. But in our journey right here, dealing with impermanence, we could look on our deathbed. What would we remember as most important? And of course, we're making it up unless we're actually in that situation. It's hard to feel that in its wholeness. The more fully we can connect with it, the more potent the insight might be. But whatever your situation is, if you can just imagine or connect with that reality, let it affect you, learn from it. So again, we'll just contemplate holding our mind to the notion of what we would remember as most important on our deathbed, looking back at our life. So we'll take a minute to do that. And I don't know about you. I wonder what you felt. I know for myself, I can't help but think about my relationships, my family, friends, and loved ones. It's not that other things might not come to be the fore and be interesting, but ultimately it feels like these relationships are so important and that our time is so precious. It's bittersweet and beautiful because we have this particular configuration now and it's always changing and moving. So it takes a lot of courage to let ourselves feel that reality. And sometimes what I find is that if I can remember that the fight I might have today, I won't remember in a year or 5 years, or will it really matter in 10 years? Then again, some conflicts are so fundamental that we have to be honest with ourselves and say, you know what? Maybe this isn't a healthy relationship. Maybe I'm not being respected. It's so personal. But the potency of looking at impermanence is that it really distills for us what's truly important. It helps us get back to ground zero. On our path, we have more freedom as we have more love. As we have more love, we feel more freedom. No one wants to be hooked into the barbs of anger or frustration or habitual problems. The last teaching, final destination, you could say, on our journey together is that of the genuine heart of sadness. This teaching is unique to Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche and the Shambhala teachings. It is dear and maybe dearest to my heart, though all of these are nothing but pure nectar from the teachings. But this one is very, very powerful for me, and we all have our own sort of connection. It's actually said that if we have a certain teaching that really inspires us or draws us, we should go with that. That we really should nurture that inspiration. So there's a quality here of there's this notion of empty heart. And the quality is that when you awaken your heart to care for others and yourselves, and you want to grow with someone, you find, maybe to your surprise, that your heart is empty. As Trungpa Rinpoche says, you find you're looking into outer space. What are you? Who are you? Where is your heart? If you really look, you won't find anything tangible and solid. Of course, you might find something very solid if you have a grudge against someone or if you have fallen possessively in love. But that is not awakened heart. So there's four aspects that I'll focus on around this genuine heart of sadness. The first is sadness. It's a quality of loneliness, and it's this sore spot we referred to in compassion. When we open our eyes to the world, we feel tremendous sadness. It's not from being mistreated. It's not from being insulted. This is a kind of sadness that happens because we can't help but care. And this goes to the second quality of unconditionally exposed or unconditionally available. When we care or love, again, we can't help but care or love. It's very personal experience. The next quality is fullness. And I think this is so cool because the word sad in English actually derives from the word satis in Latin, which is from satisfaction. Isn't that interesting? Satisfied. It's actually connected to sad. And here, Trungpa Rinpoche says, you would love to give your heart to others. This sad and tender heart is what gives birth to fearlessness. And finally, one of my favorite Trungpa Rinpoche quotes to close on is the fourth quality of raw and beautiful heart. And here he says, real fearlessness is the product of tenderness. It comes from letting the world tickle your heart, your raw and beautiful heart. You are willing to open up without resistance or shyness and face the world. You are willing to share your heart with others. This notion is so powerful that after all the complexity of life, just bringing it back down to the most simple and human level. I'll read it one more time to close. Real fearlessness is the product of tenderness. It comes from letting the world tickle your heart, your raw and beautiful heart. You are willing to open up without resistance or shyness and face the world. You are willing to share your heart with others. Thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Thank you so much, Nick. And thank you so much to everyone who joined us. That was a beautiful, beautiful talk, and some of the passages you read by Trungpa Rinpoche from Shambhala, The Sacred Path of the Warrior, are also the nearest and dearest to my heart. And I really, really appreciate the way you walked us through this journey. And it is fascinating to me that sadness derives from the word for satisfaction. I'm going to totally contemplate that. So thank you. And thank you to all who joined live. And thank you to those who may be listening now to the recording. If you're listening now, you will get the recording in an email soon. And if you want to explore these notions further with Nick, he's going to be teaching a course in the Open Heart Project, an online course, a four-week course that starts August 18th called The One Heart. And there's 4 weeks of taking a deeper dive into these notions. So if that's of interest, you'll get a link to that when you get a link to the recording. And let's just close by wishing together, may all beings know love.
Hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.